You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As late as 1967, men outnumbered women 20 to 1 in American law schools, but it was in the late 1960s that a surge in female enrollment started, often as the result of hard-fought legal battles. In his new book, Equal, Women Reshape American Law, Fred Strebe tells that story of how women battled blatant inequities in America's legal system and eventually secured some of the country's highest legal positions. Mr. Strebe, who teaches nonfiction writing at Yale University, joins me now. Welcome to our show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You write that in law, women made the fastest advance in the history of American elite professions. Why do you think that happened faster than in medicine or the sciences?
I believe there was a very quick turn, and it came with 1968 and a crucial change in American draft law, when all of a sudden men who had been able to get exemptions for going to law school lost that exemption.
Yeah, so, but medical schools were different in that regard?
What mattered most, it seems, is two factors. One was that shift in the draft exemption, and the other is that a number of women had begun to admire the law as an area for potential change, particularly with civil rights law, what was on their mind. A wonderful, emblematic story may be the story of Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is now, of course, representing the District of Columbia on the United States Congress, but who'd gone south to work on civil rights in the 1960s and had found herself all of a sudden, two workers with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee had been beaten and had gone to prison, and she had to get them out. And to get them out, she called the local sheriff. She didn't even have a law degree. She called the local sheriff and said, "I am coming down to the jail to get my two people out. I am a student at the Yale Law School, and I have called the school to tell them what I am going to do, and you had best be prepared to let my people out of jail." The potential of the law was starting to become evident for advancing civil rights.
Can women claim to be equals in today's legal establishment?
One of the fascinating questions out ahead, and I do not pretend to be a prognosticator, will be what happens when we have a court that is no longer eight men and one woman. The Supreme Court of the United States, which of course makes rulings in a top-down system, has reverted now to a ratio of men as against women that has not been seen in the entering classes of law schools since 1971. It's as if an entire generation of brilliant women is now standing ready to move into the upper realms of the court.
Although President Bush had an opportunity to make it two women with Harriet Myers, when that fell through, he wound up naming Samuel Alito.
This was a fascinating moment on two counts. First, President Bush did indeed nominate Harriet Myers, and her nomination stood for a matter of only a few weeks. It's an extraordinary situation in which the only woman whom a president of the United States could find to nominate turns out to be someone who has represented him in his campaign and in his private practice, and then steps immediately back to nominating Samuel Alito, who had always been the preferred nominee, including the preferred nominee of Harriet Myers.
Weren't there other conservative women of distinction in the legal profession?
Though I didn't follow this very closely, my understanding is that the government feared what could be called the Sandra Day O'Connor effect. Mutterings in Washington had been that Sandra Day O'Connor became more liberal over the years as she moved into the community of discussion and conversation in Washington, and there was a fear that women nominated might move to the left. But this is a story that I've not covered particularly, since I'm doing really history moving up to the current day.
So, do you think that sexism has, for the most part, been eliminated in America's elite law schools?
I think it's most important to think about the depths of sexism that existed as change began, and to move from that to a question of how well that can be extirpated. A fine story from the early days, let's say, of Justice Ginsburg, then Professor Ginsburg at Rutgers, only began working to change the law in the early 1970s.
She really hadn't seen much of a need, had she? She wasn't involved in feminist issues initially.
Justice Ginsburg, then Professor Ginsburg, wound up She was unable, when she graduated from Columbia Law School at the top of her class, she was unable to find work in firms. She was unable to obtain clerkships in major courts. She had she won, for example, a clerkship to the Supreme Court of the United States, she would have been only the second clerk who was a woman ever on the Supreme Court. And by a bit of mischance, which included getting a grant with the support of a professor at Columbia, she went the only direction she could, which was to learn Swedish and become the world's expert in the United States in Swedish civil procedure. And her book on Swedish civil procedure won her tenure. But it left her in an utter backwater of the law, honestly a bit of a source of confusion to her students. There's a famous skit that was put on at Rutgers when she was teaching. Apparently she was a rather dry lecturer, and as she stood before her room, she seemed unflappable reading, and in this mock skit put on by some of her students, she was standing before the room, this would have been in the late 1960s, reading a lecture, no, a student playing Professor Ginsburg was reading a lecture, and up behind her came another student who unzipped her dress, and she did not change her view. However, what happened in 1970 did change her views in the most profound way. Groups of students began to come to her, some from her own law school, some from a neighboring law school, saying, "Something's happening in the world, Professor Ginsburg, and would you look at the way the law treats women?" For example, a very popular textbook on real estate law said quite clearly that land, like woman, is meant to be possessed. This was not fully worked out in terms of its implications, but it became part of a series of surprises for her as she began to think, perhaps there is sexism in this law that I have never been aware of. Now, the depth of it was hidden for her. There's a story that's emerged only, and so many stories are emerging only in the last few years, and this is one from the last decade. At the very time that she was having her awakening, almost unknown story, the Chief Justice of the United States at the time, Warren Burger, delivered a letter of resignation to the White House because he had heard that then-President Richard Nixon was thinking of nominating a woman to his court.
And this is Warren Burger, who was more liberal than many of the Republicans who had been named to the Supreme Court at that time.
He was not, right, he was not a particularly fierce ideologue. And it turns out that President Nixon, we now know from Nixon's tapes available only recently, was in fact only, as Nixon said, quote, playing around. Quote, establishing a, quote, screen to fool people so he could, in fact, appoint, as he did, the two men that he planned to. But the Chief Justice was so surprised that he delivered a letter of resignation.
Ginsburg was the legal architect of the first equal protection case to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex, Reed versus Reed. Why was that case a landmark decision?
The case was a landmark decision in large part as a credit to her. Fascinating story of how she came to that case and had to change it. I'll tell you the story as it reached me first by wonderful litigator Mel Wolf, then legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union, which had the case of Reed. First, the basic fact of Reed. Odd, small-scale discrimination case in which a child died. A mother and a father each might have been the administrator of the estate. In fact, they had separated. The mother, in a way, blamed the father. The mother wanted to administer the estate, and the state in which they lived had a simple law, which is when it comes to administering an estate, guys have preference, women don't.
But women were given preference over custody of children, so I guess it was seen as some kind of trade-off.
And in this particular situation, the custody was in fact had certain points been shared. What was peculiar was this split in which women could absolutely not could not administer an estate, and thus the question was, should that be permitted under federal law? It seemed to be, and here's the key term, it seemed to be an irrational discrimination that permitted men to have an automatic right that women did not have in this administration of states. And the case had come up through the ACLU. The ACLU was prepared to litigate on the fairly limited grounds of rationality, which would not have created the major advance in the law that Professor Ginsburg wanted. What Professor Ginsburg wished was that the law start to see discrimination against women as deserving truly close and strict scrutiny. Now, the story told by Mel Wolf of the ACLU, and he tells it wonderfully, is of winding up at the door at Rutgers Law School in Newark, where then-Professor Ginsburg is teaching. And this is a special situation because he knew her when she was a 12-year-old at a summer camp, and he was a star 16-year-old, and to her, she was Kiki. Her name, not Ruth, but Kiki, K-I-K-I. And they talked. He talked about the work, important work he'd been doing opposing the Vietnam War. As he recalled, she mentioned to him doing what he called some, quote, down and dirty women's rights work, end quote, with the New Jersey Civil Liberties Union. That work that she had been doing, which mattered passionately to her with women who had been turned away from jobs, led her into dialogue again with the National ACLU, with Mel Wolf, and the case, the Reed case that you've mentioned. And when she asked Mel if he would send her the materials that he'd written to advance the law, what she saw was a very limited initiative on the part of the ACLU to advance the law. And she then, in many subtle ways, I should say I know this because I was given the chance to work in her private litigation files, her personal letters. I should perhaps explain more about how that came to pass. But what becomes clear looking at her letters is that over a period of weeks, she maneuvered, very gently but surely pushed the ACLU to offer her a role in this litigation, and thus was able to turn the Reed case into not in itself a major victory in pushing the law towards strict scrutiny of discrimination against women, but to what became the first in a series of carefully measured litigation steps that she then became the leader of.
So she opened up the door.
She absolutely opened the door and then proceeded to bring cases to her, one case after another. And I must say, as the cases proceeded, her goal was to push the law in directions it hadn't gone. The pushback is absolutely fascinating. Let me give one example, which is the case of Sharon Frontiero. And now here we're talking about a truly major pivotal moment in the history of American discrimination law involving women. The Reed was the first case in which she delivered a brief for the court. Frontiero was the first case in which she went to argue for the court. Her time was constricted. She was supposed to have the full argument, but a male litigator insisted quite late that he wanted to hold a case that he'd been ready to turn over to her, and she only had 10 minutes. She made what really was the major argument of the day, which is that discrimination against women should be taken as seriously as discrimination by race, should be given what the court calls strict scrutiny. And in what must be the strangest debut argument in the history of the Supreme Court, she spoke for 10 minutes and no justice interrupted her. This is almost unheard of. But then, very much behind closed doors in documents that I've seen from the justices' papers, one of the justices, William Brennan, began to push that strict scrutiny was, in fact, the direction the law should take. Shortening this story, the pushback that stopped what could have been a victory came from another justice in the Supreme Court who argued, we're now in the early 1970s, and he argued that the Equal Rights Amendment, which had been overwhelmingly passed by the Congress and had been passed by most states in the United States, in fact blocked the court from taking action because the court would be taking action that would forestall a political process. The deep irony of this, and this only shows when you look at the court's documents, is that the Equal Rights Amendment was needed in significant part to correct flawed decisions of the Supreme Court over many, many decades. This was the court's opportunity to correct itself rather than to need an utterly overwhelming vote in the nation. And so the court's, in effect, the court's own flaws were used to justify not correcting the court's own flaws.
My guest is Fred Strebe, Strebeigh. His book, Equal, Women Reshape American Law, is published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Fred Strebe, who teaches nonfiction writing at Yale University. His book, Equal, Women Reshape American Law, is published by Norton. Let's go back to the time when women were kept out of law schools. What were the arguments given then for keeping them out?
I can give you pieces of that story, and perhaps one of the most interesting involved evident discrimination against students, against women in, for example, winning scholarships. One of the pivotal moments that opened consideration by women in the law schools of the discrimination against them came in the fall of 1968 in New York City at the New York University School of Law. And two women were standing next to each other. One was a first-year law student and the other was a second-year law student. Their names were Janice Goodman and Susan Deller Ross. And one said to the other, "Did you know that the Ruth Tilden Scholarship is open only to men?" And quickly they went back and forth and said, "Shouldn't we do something about that?" Now, the Ruth Tilden Scholarship was known nationwide as America's richest law scholarship. It paid not only free tuition but $10,000 per year at a time when young attorneys were often receiving only $8,000 or $10,000 to start their careers. So this was a major law school scholarship in the nation. It was designed for future leaders. And to cut back in time ever so slightly, when Eleanor Holmes Norton, who undeniably became a future leader, applied to New York University School of Law, she wanted a Ruth Tilden Scholarship. Her family did not have much money. And she received a response back saying, "No, it's reserved only for men." And when I was speaking with her, when I was interviewing her, she told me that she'd assumed that there was a foundation or a donor who had specified this was only for men. In fact, the foundation had specified that it was for leaders.
This is just NYU policy. Was it because of the entrenched law professors who just wanted it that way? Did they women were going to disrupt the class?
It seems almost precisely to be the case. What happened with this emblematic scholarship is that a particular dean of the law school in the 1950s had sought it with a concept of leadership in mind. It had then continued as a male-only scholarship. Oh, it mattered to him and also to others. Camaraderie mattered among these young future leaders of America. And the camaraderie included, in his defense of this, the all-male dormitories, the potential to run naked, the bonding experience of quite precisely throwing water-filled water balloons at each other, this notion of male bonding in a community of leaders. When Janice Goodman and Susan Deller Ross, these then young law students at NYU, began to investigate how they would break what they understood to be a trust which limited the law school to men only, they learned two things. First of all, they learned that there had not been exactly a trust. There were only letters. Then they learned that 2 years before, the law school faculty had voted that they should not restrict this scholarship only to men, but the law school faculty had not particularly acted on it. And third, they learned that the particular dean who had been in charge of assembling this all-male scholarship went to the foundation that had given it to ask if, in fact, it could include women. The foundation said, "Yes, of course you can." So it seems that an entrenched notion of leadership as synonymous with male leadership ran throughout the law school system, at least in this narrative.
And then you say that when women began to enter the courtroom, the law resisted. How did male-dominated law firms push back against integration? They didn't hire Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you said. She had to go Swedish law. She probably knows more about Volvo sales in America than than any other Supreme Court justice.
I have her civil procedure in Sweden book on my shelves. I pulled it out of the long-term shelving facility of the Yale Library where books go to die. And yes, her range of knowledge is immense there.
So a woman graduates near the top of her class, Ruth Bader Ginsburg did, and still can't get a job?
Let me give you a wonderful epitomizing example. It is both Ruth Bader Ginsburg and a case and another now judge in the United States. The pivotal case for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the case that she thought was her perfect case, is a case involving the Wiesenfeld family, Paula Wiesenfeld and Stephen Wiesenfeld and Jason Wiesenfeld. When it went to the Supreme Court, this is a case with which she hoped to change the law more than with any other case.
She was a lawyer then or a justice?
Thank you. She was at that point a young professor teaching at Columbia and working as an attorney. This would be in 1973 or so. The justices at the court split dramatically in their consideration of the case. I know this from the Supreme Court conference notes. And they seemed to be a very split court, one in which she would be lucky to win a significant vote. But there was a new clerk in the court. Her name was Marcia Berzon, and some of your listeners will recognize her name. Marcia Berzon had graduated at the top of her class at Bolt Hall Law School at the University of California, Berkeley. And that was a year in which Bolt Hall had the option to select the clerk for Justice William Brennan. Of course, the clerkships at the Supreme Court lead to future distinction, and Brennan said no. And he said no because she was a woman.
The most liberal of all the justices.
Great liberal line of the courts refused her. And apparently he had refused one other woman before who, again, had been – it is the right of the school to – he had offered the school a chance to designate. He turned Marcia Berzon back, but in – would have been spring 1973. This time Berkeley fought back. It did not cave. Justice Brennan is the one who caved. Marcia Berzon became a young clerk in his chambers, the very first one, and then he came to trust her. He handed her a leadership role in considering this case brought by Justice Ginsburg. She did extra work, gathered a legal history, and it's very clear from the internal documents, Marcia Berzon turned a split court into a unanimous court in support of Justice Ginsburg. But if the great liberal lion, William Brennan, had had his way, two losses. Judge Marcia Berzon, who now, by the way, is Judge Marcia Berzon of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California, would not have had that crucial step in her career towards her current judgeship, and now Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg might have not had anything like the major victory that she won.
My guest is Fred Strebe. His book, Equal, Women Reshape American Law, published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One case you focus on is a sexual discrimination suit against the prominent Wall Street firm Sullivan and Cromwell. They were probably the most distinguished law firm on Wall Street at the time. What happened there? What did the ruling against Sullivan and Cromwell mean?
The story of the case of Sullivan and Cromwell is a very early case of young law students, in this case particularly New York University and Columbia, finding that when they went to interviews for positions at major law firms, they were limited in particular ways. This case, which involved the then young attorney and then young would-be attorney, Diane Blank, now in private practice in New York City, included an interview in which she was told, and I don't have this verbatim in my memory, though I do in the book, by one of the interviewers, that some of our partners don't like women as attorneys, or some of our partners discriminate against women as attorneys. This is me being imprecise and paraphrasing at the moment. In any event, that combined with some other experiences with resistance from law firms to hiring women led to a case of discrimination being brought by Diane Blank against Sullivan and Cromwell. The most remarkable turn of events occurred in that case when the judge for the case was drawn out of a drum in New York City, New York Federal Court, on a court in which there was only one woman among 20-odd judges, and the name that came out was Judge Constance Baker Motley. Judge Constance Baker Motley, herself a graduate of Columbia Law School, found her dream job when she was still in college working with a young attorney named Thurgood Marshall with an NAACP legal defense fund. And Constance Baker Motley had worked on the great school desegregation case, Brown v. Board of Education, and many of the pivotal anti-discrimination cases in the South. Drawn out of a drum, Judge Motley was also drawn into this case. And she proceeded to assess it as much as a normal judging experience until quite remarkable turns of events began. The attorney hired by Sullivan and Cromwell, not within Sullivan and Cromwell, but hired, began to suggest that, in fact, she was biased against his firm because of a mindset that, as he put it, more or less was a mindset to support those who had been discriminated against, those who were aggrieved, a mindset that mindset that went back to her early days, and as the case proceeded, tried to have Judge Motley moved off the case. In interviewing Judge Motley, as she saw him moving against her, she was first shocked. She then drew strength from at least one other judge, an African-American judge who had been tried to push off a case by another attorney, and she held her ground. Her court backed her, and Judge Motley stayed on the case, and at a certain point, she decided to push this case forward in multiple ways, and the attorney pushed back in a way that reminded her of her early days as an anti-discrimination attorney. He began to suggest, his key terms are obscure in the law to me and to you and to everyone. He began to suggest this is a case of what he called barratry and champerty. And what he was suggesting amounted to a virtual conspiracy between an attorney and a plaintiff to bring a frivolous lawsuit. When she was young, working with the NAACP, anti-discrimination lawyers of the NAACP had faced this same charge, and as she heard it again, it strengthened her sense that this was a case that she had to do her best to bring forward and to bring to conclusion.
And Sullivan and Cromwell lost. And last year, they wound up faced with a similar kind of thing in a sexual harassment case involving a gay associate. And they settled that one out of court. So some things don't change, I guess. But what has happened is that the law seems to have changed. You write that the courts used to insist that rape victims fight their attackers almost to the death to prove their lack of consent. You devote a whole chapter of your book to pregnancy. And then you write a lot about sexual harassment. And all of those things have changed because of women in the law, or just because of changing attitudes in this country?
The very first book written about sexual harassment law made the simple observation that this was a law that might not change until there were more women beginning to litigate the case of sexual harassment. This seems to be a situation in which the law has changed overwhelmingly because it finally opened the gates of the law to women, gates that had been closed for many decades.
In fact, it had no name in the courts for a while, and sexual harassment was tolerated as just the way people were.
The arrivement of sexual harassment as a term in the law is absolutely a story of young women beginning to tell each other stories and finally getting those stories into the hands of attorneys who could begin to bring cases. The story of the origin of sexual harassment law seems to come out of Cornell University, and in the 1970s, middle 1970s, an employee of Cornell University found herself under strain working with one of her employers, and came to a small group of women then working at Cornell University with a problem that had no name. She was being imposed on by her boss, and they sat around and came up with the term sexual harassment And decided to bring others together, who bring women together to talk about that experience. And thus, the notion that the term sexual harassment and the concept of sexual harassment began to spread in the law.
Now, Joe Biden plays a prominent role in the last chapter of your book. We often don't think of him as a women's rights leader, but he says that he considers one of his piece of legislation the most important accomplishment he had as a legislator.
And furthermore, and this is something that he said very, very clearly in the last few years. This is the story of Joe Biden and the origins of the Violence Against Women Act. And it seems that beginning in at least the 1980s, Senator Biden then had wanted to change the law to reduce violence against women, and particularly on his mind, he tells the story, in 1981, was trying to reduce what is known as the so-called marital rape exemption. Now, what the marital rape exemption does is provide, it diminishes the charge of what would be a sexual assault when that sexual assault takes place, not between strangers or acquaintances, but within a married relationship. And Biden tells a story in his campaign autobiography of speaking with then-Senator Jeremiah Denton about wanting, in the Judiciary Committee of the Senate, to change the law to support women and reduce the marital rape exemption, of Jeremiah Denton saying, more or less, and I'm paraphrasing now, well, Joe, you know, when you're married, you want to be able to get a little sex anyway. Again, that's a paraphrase, a story that Biden tells. And this had stayed on Biden's mind. And in the 1990s, another story crossed. And he turned to a young attorney, one of the only women in that part of the Judiciary Committee, and asked her to begin to research what could be done by the United States Senate on behalf of women, and thus originated the Violence Against Women Act.
Well, we have a new act, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which is in response to the Supreme Court decision about another discrimination against women, in this case equal pay, which suggests that we have not completely finished this debate.
The Ledbetter Act, which did indeed say it altered a Supreme Court decision which had ruled that women bringing a charge of discrimination on the basis of pay had a very limited time in which to bring the charge, seems to be a signal of the direction taken by the new administration. Not only did the Lilly Ledbetter Act eliminate that earlier decision by the court, but it was the subject of a wonderful signing ceremony. I believe it was the first signing ceremony involving the Obama White House. Joseph Biden was there. Many women whose stories are told in Equal, indeed, appeared. This seems to signal a new direction in a new administration.
Fred Strebe's book, Equal, Women Reshape American Law, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.